Welcome to the Euro Hockey Institute podcast, in conversation with the biggest names in sport, generating insight and engagement around coaching, officiating, and playing hockey. Presented by Jack Rolfe.
We have a special edition of the Euro Hockey Institute podcast this week. We've actually changed the game up. The interviewer is becoming the interviewee. And so this week, we're actually going to talk to Jack Rolfe, our star interviewer from the last four series of the podcast, about his life in coaching. So Jack, first of all, I mean, lots of people have seen you on the podcast for the last couple of years. Maybe do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and your coaching history?
Yeah, number one, it feels very weird to be on the other side, and I guess very privileged having gone from Christopher Ruhr last week to now me. I feel very honoured to be here. I guess I'm, an unintended coach. I never planned to be a coach. The first aspiration was always to play hockey for England, and that's maybe where the coaching really began. And when I didn't make the England squad at 18, somebody said, come and do some coaching, and that was my first opportunity. I'm a dyslexic, so I probably think very differently as well, and maybe that's influenced how I love and how much I love my coaching. And probably at school I wasn't very good at anything, so to find something I was half decent at and absolutely loved in the coaching space in a sport that I absolutely love and continue to do so, it's really nice to be on the other side. You can probably tell from my Australian twang over the past four seasons, which has probably got a little bit more exaggerated over every episode. I'm currently in Australia. A six-month trip has turned into is three and a bit years now. So I'm an Englishman abroad, which I'm sure we'll talk about. And definitely living the dream, Stephen, and feel very privileged to do what I do.
But also doing so in a number of different ways. Also, you've got your coaching lab, and you've kind of expanded out from just hockey into a much wider world through your coaching cards and various different initiatives like that. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. My biggest learning has probably come from outside of hockey in a way. Hockey's will always be my love and my sport, but probably some of my biggest learnings come from outside of that in professional football. At academies like Arsenal, at Reading, at people at Liverpool, Brighton, Man United, Rangers, those sorts of people that I've had the privilege to spend time with and interact with, that has definitely learned a lot for me. And to come and pull that back into the hockey world has been a real privilege. And the coaching lab was started 5 years ago in September, actually as a mad, stupid, crazy idea from the university library around how can we support more coaches around some of the sports psychology and to play more games. And the byproduct of that was some challenge cards, which are multi-sport now, but started in hockey. And have hopefully had an amazing impact with loads of different people.
Okay, I mean, you've touched on a large number of things there, which we'll probably get to throughout the podcast. But I mean, let's take it back a little bit. I mean, you mentioned there you're kind of an accidental coach around about the age of 18. Tell me, who were the kind of key people who kind of got you involved in coaching, and what was the kind of thing that kind of saw you shift from the playing side a bit more onto the coaching side?
Yeah, definitely. I won't name the coaches that I didn't want to be like, because I think that was always something. When I first started, I was, I guess, quite reflective, and I kind of had a bit of an idea of who I wanted to be like and who I didn't want to be like, let's say that. And one of the first people would have been Mike Joyce. I remember sitting in a hotel room or in a hotel lobby in lovely Warsaw in Birmingham in the UK. And I think we were just about to go and play in the Mercia Lynx kind of Futures Cup final. And we had a squad of 16, 18, and nine of those boys went on to play, or even more, maybe went on to play at the top level in international hockey. And I was one of those that didn't. And I remember Mike Joyce, who now works for the FIH, said to me, Jack, do you want to come and do some coaching over the summer? You should, you'd love it and you'd get involved. And I didn't know any different. So I said, yes, 100% straight away. And I remember going to Moulton College, and that first interaction with loads of different people was really positive, and probably met my best mate there in Panda, in Graham Mansell Grace, is someone that I probably speak to almost every single day, maybe more than my parents sometimes, but he's had a massive influence on me. Early other people would have been, and continue to be, Nick Clark at Kent College was massive for me, and I guess a little bit later into my early years at coaching at university, someone that really taught me what was right and what was wrong, and a role model of what youth sport should be about and how to create connections before correcting people. I think that was a massive thing. And maybe I also reflect back on my first coach, Trevor Chandler, at Little Aylesbury Hockey Club. I went to the most standard comprehensive state school in the world. And there was a poster on the wall and it said, come and play hockey for 6 weeks. And I said, yes. And I still remember that, him being the first coach and encouraging me to then join the club. And hopefully I've had a similar interaction maybe with the people that I work with now, around just giving them the confidence to, you know, step forward into a club setting and really take their hockey forward.
Yeah. A lot of good young players obviously, you know, use coaching for a bit of kind of pocket money and kind of, you know, maybe don't think too kind of deeply about it. At what stage did you kind of, did it go from just kind of, oh, this is kind of handy to get a few quid over the summer and, you know, it doing something I quite enjoy, and then to kind of think a bit more, maybe a bit more deeply about it? Were there kind of particular steps that you remember that helped this along the way?
Yeah, I was going to go to university and be a PE teacher like every, I guess, hockey player would do, and every, you know, sporting loving individual. And I rocked up to the university open day, ready to speak to the person from phys ed. And they were busy, so I had to wait. And I believe everything happens for a reason. And I got talking to this man, and he knew a few people I knew and whatever. And turns out his daughter played hockey for England, or Grace Ballston, continues to do so. And Andy Ballston was leading on a coaching program at Canterbury Christchurch University. And that was probably the real tipping point for me to realise, okay, I can focus on coaching and not necessarily the teaching side, although there's a, you know, there's a coexistence there. But to have a whole degree of 3 years to really focus on coaching, that was the opportunity. I thought, okay, maybe this is a little bit more real. And I guess the big thing for me was, whilst I studied, I was able to coach all the way alongside that. And just those two sequences together really opened my eyes to what coaching was about. And in those 3 years at Christchurch University, you know, some amazing school trips and study trips to different places, which was able to show me, okay, this is a career, or this is an opportunity that I've got to take with both hands and absolutely make the most of.
Obviously, the kind of the coaches for Europe kind of thing with the EHF comes in at some point along the way. Tell me about how important that is in the kind of in your development. I mean, you talk a little bit about kind of chance encounters with Andy Ballston and Mike Joyce along the way, but that must have been another kind of step that introduced you to another wider realm.
Yeah, definitely. I think Canterbury accelerated it, particularly when Canterbury is closer to Europe than it is closer to most of the cities in the UK. Yeah, it's easy to get to Europe, and we had a lot of European players come and play, and as the club was playing in Europe at the time, and you know, I took the under 14 girls to play in the club Europeans at the time, and it opened my eyes to what Europe was about. And to me, it was always and probably always will be the capital of hockey. And all the coaches I looked up to, Stephen, and do so now, that all spent time outside of the UK. All the coaches I looked up to had spent time, whether that was small, big, or whatever, spent time outside of the UK. And I didn't want to be a sheep. I didn't want to be someone that was exactly the same as everyone and read from the same hymn sheet of, you know, certain bingo words. I kind of wanted to be a little bit different, maybe. And I guess I was very grateful I had the opportunity and the time to do so during university, to maybe take my coaching a bit slower so I could afford to go and have 2 weeks in Europe, or go and have a 1 week with the EHF, which was eye-opening to me. When you watch YouTube on Hoofklaster, or you go for a long weekend, you probably don't get some of the interactions that you would get on a EHF coaching course, particularly over 2 years. And it accelerated my coaching, accelerated my love for the game, but also probably made me very reflective on what type of coach I am and maybe could be, or what other coaches are like. So that was a real chapter in my coaching.
Yeah. Over the course of the podcast series, you've spoken to kind of a number of your kind of contemporaries about and coming from very, very different backgrounds. You know, I think most recently, say, Tim Matkovic, and kind of him developing his coaching in Croatia, and then how that kind of, and him being on one of the Coaches for Europe programs. I mean, is that one of the kind of the beauty of it, that you can talk to some of your contemporaries from very, very different backgrounds, very different sort of sets of challenges and limitations?
Yeah, the beautiful thing about sport and not just hockey is we all play the same game, but often we play it very differently. And we live in very different countries and different environments. And that's the beautiful thing about sport, and maybe even more so in hockey, that you can cross the border from Belgium and you go to Croatia, and it's, yes, it's in Europe, but it's completely different, but they're playing the same game. So it gave me a real appreciation for how lucky I am to be involved in hockey, but also gave me an appreciation. Growing up in England, I often felt we were, you know, maybe a little bit arrogant at times, and maybe we didn't realise just how lucky we were. You know, if we're playing on a sand-based pitch, there's probably a better hockey pitch than some of these people are playing on in Europe. You know, we might complain about the quality of the hockey balls or whatever, but some people haven't got the equipment or the opportunities that we've got. So it really kind of a humbling experience as much as an educational one.
Okay, and then tell me about your kind of journey with that. When did you start, and what were the kind of the key parts of the Coaching for Europe program for you?
Yeah, I guess the experimental kind of learning element to it. Like a lot of coaches, we don't like to sit in a lecture and just be spoken to. It's those powerful conversations, whether that was more formally or, may I say, kind of over a beer in the evenings after a conversation where you're moving salt and peppers around on the table at breakfast, and you're talking about the learning from the day before. And over 2 years, you get to watch an incredible amount of hockey, both in watching games, but also watching other coaches coach. And that was a real valuable part for me, because you may watch three coaches deliver the same practice, in brackets, but actually delivered in three very different ways, which when you grow up in the UK, you probably don't get that as much because everyone is maybe very similar. But when you go into a room of 20 different people, with maybe 15 different nationalities, that opportunity and chance to watch other people, to speak to other people, was incredibly valuable and important.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the list of your mentors on it, Bernardo Fernandez, Norbert Nadeloff, kind of who's coached all sorts of different places around the world, Tomislav Jamicic. I mean, really, really diverse set of ideas coming through to you there.
Oh, absolutely. It brings a smile to my face as I speak. And, you know, you take a little bit from everyone. Tommy Hockey, the guy drives around Europe in a caravan with some magic hockey tricks and inspires kids in Croatia. And, you know, just talking about it brings a smile to my face. And that's what coaching is about. And you talk to Norbert, like the BFG, the big friendly giant. He walks into a room and everyone kind of stops and listens and looks, and he just captivates the room with his big iPad Pro, and he gets his Apple Pencil out, and he might talk about guitars 1 minute and being in a band, and then suddenly he's talking about how to hold a hockey stick. And you know, that sounds really silly around how to hold a hockey stick, but that foundation principle was I guess eye-opening for me. And little things like, I guess for all the mentors, it wouldn't just be tell you, it would be show. You know, so they might talk about something, but they're going to show that with some sort of foundation and reasoning behind it. And now, and it's massively influenced my coaching, is when Norbert shows you how to hold a hockey stick, and then you go and watch kids play hockey, you see how many different ways kids hold hockey sticks. And it's incredible. You might have the left hand halfway down the stick, or you might have the right hand, you know, all the way over the front of the stick. And it's, you know, little things like that. And it sounds incredibly simple. But if it wasn't for Coaches for Europe, you wouldn't have that detail and that eye for detail and knowledge and desire to learn.
Is the conclusion that there's no right way to hold the hockey stick, or is it that there should be one way to hold the hockey stick?
If you ask Norbert, there is a right and the wrong way. I think there's probably a foundation, let's say, that where your left and your right hand will be as a starting out of the starting blocks. I think players will naturally have a bit of variation in that, but you know, the left hand at the top, and we all say left hand at the top, right hand at the bottom, but the detail of where do you put your left hand, how do you put your left wrist, that definitely influenced my coaching.
Excellent stuff. So, I mean, through all this, I mean, your business kind of evolved. I mean, as I understand, is kind of part of your final year dissertation there at Christ Church College, that, the kind of this add-on to your coaching came along and then, you know, became a hugely important part of your career. Tell us about how that evolved.
Yeah, so I founded the Coaching Lab in 2018 from a university dissertation on sports psychology and how do coaches integrate and develop psychological skills. And like I said at the top, I'm dyslexic, so I don't really like words. And when you're presented with 15,000 words of study from football academies, from really great coaches and interviews, you're thinking, okay, well, how do I make this meaningful and impactful? And the coaching cards and match play cards was the byproduct of that, and really started as a concept to support hockey coaches, and has gone much further and much wider to further afield. I think we're at 55 different countries at the moment. And I guess the impact of Europe, coaches for Europe and EHF and hockey in general has had an impact on that, because hockey is the same game as football, but just with a couple of different rules. It's the same game as basketball, just with a couple of different rules. You know, the invasion principles are very similar. So my foundations in hockey have supported and definitely opened a few doors for me elsewhere in the professional sporting environment.
Yeah, give us an example of what might be written on one of these cards, and then how you'd feel would be the right time to kind of introduce it into a session.
Yeah, super. So let's say, every coach has always got a mixed ability group. There's often a kid or a player that stands still in the back corner. There's often one that's really talkative, and then there's often the one that doesn't talk or doesn't say anything at all. Or you shout at the kids. Hopefully you don't shout at the kids, but you tell the kids to pass the ball. And they don't pass the ball. So we created a set of resources and challenge cards that might say, as a team challenge, and I might give this to your team, Stephen, if we're playing a bit of 5v5 in training, it might be the value of the goal is worth the amount of players involved. And my challenge for my team might be every three tackles we make, we get a player from the opposition. So they're kind of almost team challenges playing against each other. It could also be as simple as, you're the only person that's allowed to speak on your team. Or I might give you a card because I've seen you very quiet, maybe not getting involved as much as, you know, you'd like to as the coach. And I might give you a secret mission card, which might say the next goal's worth triple, but I might not tell anybody else. I might give that card to you, Stephen, in the small sided game that we're playing. And, you know, so you go and score and everyone goes crazy because it's worth three. And we're trying to work out what you're doing. So team challenges and some player challenges in there.
Yeah. And how do you kind of come up with the ideas, like with the kind of, in terms of what your prescribed goals are or unprescribed goals are in each one? I mean, do you kind of think about, you know, all the different kind of motivations that all the players might have to then kind of engage them? Is that part of the process?
Yeah, definitely. So we created 100 different cards and all around constraints, which in other ways is just, in other words, just kind of rules and challenges. So we might restrict something but promote something else. So we might say, okay, you can't pass more than five times on your team, which will encourage more running with the ball. So little challenges like that. And it all came around, we never want coach or players, sorry, to ask, when are we going to play a game? I really don't believe that's a question that any player should ask. So they should actually ask, what game are we going to play today? So all the cards are around games-based activities. So not the drill, unopposed practice, but very much around playing 3v3s with the under-8s or the under-10s to playing 6v6, 7v7 with the under-18s or even much further up and beyond.
And like that, is it something primarily targeted at kind of children's coaching, or is this something that works well as well with the kind of adult world?
Yeah, I'm going to play devil's advocate. I think it's always the skill of the coach to do so. I've done a project with a senior international football team trying to win a World Cup using the same cards. But I've also used the same cards with the under-10s on a Sunday morning. But it's the skill of the coach on how you give those in. And like we said, we all play the same game, but at different speeds and over different sizes. So the principles are the same. But primarily, we started with the youngsters, with the kids, and we've gone above and beyond a few age ranges that we targeted.
Yeah. You mentioned kind of working with a number of Premier League clubs. Tell me a little bit about the process, about how did they get in contact, and, you know, what was that, you going out to them or word of mouth, or yeah, how did it happen?
Interesting. So all the clubs we've ever done work with have we've never approached. They've always approached us, which is interesting, which often says a lot about the sports because they want to get better, which is great. I'll take West Ham, for example. I had no idea that West Ham were using them until someone told me on a podcast that West Ham were using them. And I had to ask who was the coach that was using them because he ordered them with his non-West Ham email address. So I had absolutely no idea that he was the academy lead. And I reached out to him when I found out about 2 years after they were using them. And I went to spend the afternoon at the academy expecting to spend 1 hour there, as you know, a lot of these environments are quite intense with time and tight on time. And I think I was the last person to leave the training ground at about 10:30 at night. And we spoke coaching, but we didn't really speak football, which was interesting. You know, we spoke about just coaching kids and how do we develop kids and, you know, how do we coach this sort of person and that sort of person. But not once did we really mention the word football or even hockey. But they were quite curious in the world of hockey because it's such a quick, dynamic game around how do we coach that chaos element to it, whereas football's a little bit more structured at times. So, yeah, all the academies that we've ever done work with have actually always reached out to us through word of mouth, which is really powerful, but also says a lot about those environments.
Yeah, obviously, got a couple of Champions League names got mentioned there. I think, did you say Arsenal, Liverpool, a few others, Man United? Yeah, again, how much kind of interaction have you had with them? And, you know, have you had that kind of same thing that you had with West Ham?
Yeah, so those guys are in the academy, so a little bit younger. I know that Liverpool under 18s use our cards for around adaptability and communication, which is pretty powerful. And I think probably within the next couple of years, we would know that some of those players that are having gone through the under 18s will hopefully make a Premier League debut for Liverpool, and to know they've the cards had a very, very, very small influence on that person is incredible. Arsenal was one of the first ever clubs I had the chance to visit, and I'm a huge Arsenal fan. So that's incredibly powerful to go and see a product that I designed work in that environment. And interestingly enough, Arsenal has a big European influence, you know, with Per Mertesacker and a lot of the Dutch academy coaches that have gone through that system. So they're always fascinated by hockey, you know, particularly any Dutch coach that works in England and German to a certain degree as well is fascinated by hockey and has a connection to hockey before. And I guess Dennis Bergkamp was a prime example of that and the reason we managed to get him on the EHF podcast.
Yeah, I was going to ask, it's gone kind of full circle now with this sort of also playing fairly high level hockey as well. Yeah. You've kind of touched on it there as well, Victor, about the little Australian twang that's kind of developed. I mean, yeah, tell us about the move to Australia, how that came about and how it kind of, yeah, maybe a little bit about how it compares to your time in Europe.
Yeah, I was always keen to leave England. I don't say that in a bad way. I was just always keen to expand. I'm single. I didn't have a house. I didn't have, you know, there was no mortgage to pay, and I had the opportunity to escape, I guess, and to make the most of that. My first chance in Australia came 5 years ago when I came to house sit for Craig Boyne's parents in Perth. I worked with Craig at Kent College in Canterbury, and it was a good opportunity because his parents were coming over to England, so they needed someone to house sit. So I went over and house sat Craig's parents' house and played hockey for 6 weeks and at YMCC. And the first night I arrived, I sat on the bench with Jamie Dwyer, Eddie Ockenden, Blake Gothers, Tyler Lovell. You know, that was my first experience of hockey in Australia. And then unfortunately had to fly back to the UK to finish my degree and finish the EHF course actually as well. And Jamie Dwyer was over in England and we stayed in contact a lot. And he was really good to me my first time in England, first time in Australia, sorry. And we were at the World Cup in London, the Women's World Cup, and we were just talking and having a beer. And he said, oh, would you ever come back? And I said, oh, I'd absolutely jump at the chance to come back. And I think probably 3 months later, I had a phone call from Jeremy saying there's an opportunity to come over. It felt the right thing to do at the time and was definitely the best decision that I've made. Had a contracted coach for a club over here to do a bit of work with JDH and just an opportunity to escape and get out. And I arrived 2 weeks before COVID hit. Didn't really know what was going on. And it was probably the best thing that, and I really believe everything happens for a reason. COVID hit 2 weeks in and I'm still here. And thanks to Jamie and thanks to those opportunities that, yeah, Perth is maybe home for a little bit longer.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I mean, I've got a couple of friends who do the Reverse Tick podcast and they said Perth was probably the best place in the world as the most remote city in the world that it was to be when lockdowns came and things like that. So pretty nice position to be in. Tell me just about that particular moment, though, when you've got, like you say, Eddie Ockenden, Jamie Dwyer, Tyrone Lovell, all these guys on the bench. Do you kind of, do you know, I don't know, plenty of people would have kind of like a imposter syndrome or something like that, kind of going, this is like probably one of the greatest benches that I'm sitting on in the world. But, you know, with your attitude and things like that, you seem to, did you take it in your stride?
Yeah, you have to respect them, right? And probably influences the relationship I'd have with a lot of people. You have to respect that. And maybe the difference in over here in Australia is all the international players are drafted. And a lot of them are, yes, full-time athletes, but actually have a job during the day. So they maybe don't come with the ego or the personality of I am just a hockey player. So a lot of these people have a dare I say a real life job kind of during the day and very personable people. So I guess they made it just as easy for me to have a conversation after as well. And it is also the power of sport, right? Because we both play we all play the same game but at very different levels. But of course there's an element of being starstruck. But it's also an element of, okay, I've got an opportunity here to learn from some of the best players in the world. And because all the players are drafted to different teams, you play with and against some of the best players in the world week in, week out when the Pro League isn't on. And when I was playing, it was tough because you're just chasing everybody around. But when you get a chance to watch it, it's magical.
And how do you think that the kind of the attitude or the, I mean, obviously, you know, we see it in the top level games. The style is usually quite different to a kind of a European style. But in terms of how it's coached and how it's kind of the kind of things that go on behind the scenes, how do you think it differs?
Yeah, I think every halftime team talk I've been part of has always been around work harder than the opposition. So I definitely think work ethic has an influence. And the major game in Australia is AFL, Australian Rules, which is a fast-paced, it's a direct, quick, pretty rough sort of game. And it's very different to, let's say, a Spanish tiki-taka sort of soccer-style game, which definitely has then an influence on how other people play sports. So because football, AFL, has such a big influence in here, that then influences hockey and some of the others, doing some pick and rolls and roll on your forehand and around the tires and often finish with a game. But, you know, a simple thing, when I first arrived, I remember we played 7v7 training, which everyone would do all around the world. But one of the simple things they did, they got rid of the hockey ball and played with a tennis ball. The most simple thing in the world of over here, they call it kind of TGFU, teaching games for understanding. They just changed the rules of the game and we played with a tennis ball. And you're playing with some of the best players with a tennis ball. You know, so little things like that. We'd often add different rules. They like free touch or, you know, very quick fire games. I think we could probably play more games over here. But it's coached very simply and I'm a very simple person. So that definitely suits me. To my ground.
The other, like over the course of this, the other thing that kind of comes across to you is just personal connections. Like I think we spoke a bit about just before about you know, whether you've just had this by luck or anything like that, or whether it's kind of you know, or whether it's you go out to kind of create these connections personally. But I mean, it's you know, from your own words, you kind of suggested you have been kind of lucky, but you are a walking CV in kind of how you carry yourself. Tell me a bit about that and how important that's been to your coaching journey to make those new connections.
It's definitely luck. I definitely feel like I've been in the right place at the right time. I don't try and be someone. I just coach and love what I do. And maybe that's had an influence on where I am and who's in my phone book and who's been helping me, I guess. You know, an example would be I was on the EHF course at Sportsways at Amsterdam, hockey club, one of the biggest hockey clubs ever. And Santi Frescher was coaching the team at the time. And I knew Santi a little bit from Twitter and talking and, you know, mutual connections. And I was stood with Panda, Graham, Mansell Grace at the bar having a coffee in the clubhouse at Amsterdam. And Santi walks in, and this is the first time I've ever met Santi in person. And he walks over and he shakes my hand and gives me a hug and says, "Jack, I know you from Twitter." And like, I didn't really like that because I don't want to be that person. But we spoke a couple of times, and you know, that was a prime example for someone who I look up to now and definitely did at the time, for someone like him to come over and know who you are and take the time to say hello was incredibly powerful. And next thing I know, I'm at Amsterdam training on a Tuesday night with Billy Backer and Prowser and Valentin Berger, and I'm pushing the trolley around with the cones and the bibs, and I'm scoring in a small-sided game because Santi invited me to train and to be part of the group. And you know, little things like that have had a massive influence and incredibly personable. I think you learn very early that hockey is a small world, maybe it's much smaller than other sports. And if you not do the wrong thing, but if you're maybe not the sort of character that people want to hang around with, that word gets about pretty damn quick, because the circles are a lot smaller. And if you're maybe good at what you do, or you try and do things in the right way and you want to learn, that also gets around maybe just as quick sometimes. So I guess I've always tried to carry myself in a good way and never be someone that people speak badly of, but also, you know, speak positively about, and just carry that forward in everything I do.
Yeah, definitely. I think your experiences and the amount of different people from various different profiles that have wanted to engage you in that kind of way is kind of testament to that. I suppose I'll finish up by just asking, so what's happening next? I mean, you've got the coaching lab, you've got your base there in Australia. I mean, have you thought too much for what the next short while brings for you?
You sound like my parents, Stephen. it's the question I get quite a bit. And I give this simple answer all the time, and people ask this all the time of like, what are you going to do next, and who are you going to coach, and what are you going to coach? And it's not a silly answer, but I just try and do something better every single day. And there's always someone in a worse situation, right? And there's always someone in a worse situation. I feel incredibly grateful to do what I do, and if I can enjoy that every single day, that's important to me. And opportunities will come about if you do the right things. If you don't do the right things, opportunities won't come about. And but if you try and carry yourself in the right way, you love what you do, and you coach with a smile, like I have a saying here, there's not a bad day in Perth. I live in one of the best cities in the world. I coach one of the most amazing sports in the world, with some of the best people ever in this very small little city in Australia, in Perth. And I just want to keep doing as much as I can to enjoy what I do and grow the coaching lab and help as many coaches as we can with that. And the resources, we know that grassroots coaches are some of the least supported individuals on a pathway. So anything we can do with the coaching lab to support those individuals is really important as well.
So we'll leave it there. I hope it wasn't too awkward being on the other side of the of the microphone for this particular one. And we look forward to having you back doing the big interviews next month on the Euro Hockey Institute podcast. But for the moment, yeah, thanks so much, Jack, for your time. And keep on trucking on.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Euro Hockey Institute podcast. Follow Euro Hockey Org on all social media to keep an eye out for the next episode.